When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
When it comes to comedy movies that parody the stories that we already know, few do it better than Mel Brooks. Throw in the comedic genius of Leslie Nielsen, and you can already hear the laughs emitting from the movie theater. Or do you? It's time to find out as we attempt to prove that Dracula, Dead and Loving It, is not that bad. Welcome, welcome, one and all, to It's Not That Bad, the podcast that looks for A grades in B movies. Now, as a Canadian, there are a few actors that we hold up in absolutely high regard because they are absolute gems. You know, we are contractually obligated to say nice things about Ryan Reynolds. It's actually in the charter. Leslie Nielsen is another one of those names. Absolute gem. Anytime he's on the screen, you're usually going to have a good laugh or a good smile. Or will you? We're about to find out. And joining us for this episode to see if the Leslie Nielsen charm can translate through to pretty much anything is Peter from the Movie Duel Podcast. Pete, welcome back to the show. How you doing, man?
I'm not too bad. Not too bad. I had a bit of an illness just after Christmas. So my voice is on and off a little bit croaky. And I've still got a bit of a lingering cough. But other than that, I'm very excited to be back and talking Dracula, Dead and Loving It.
See, I think really you just needed a little bit of time to recover from the Grading on a Curve movies of 2023 episode.
It could have been it. Yeah, it could have been some kind of that. It may be some kind of internet virus that I caught from from wading around in the that was the Grading on a Curve episode.
No amount of Pepto-Bismol could have, you know, protected you from that one. But when it came time to pick a movie for you to come back on, you said Dracula, Dead and Loving It. Hey, I was psyched because it had been a long time since I'd seen it. And I don't even think until researching that I'd watched the whole thing all the way through. But what is it about this film that made you want to pitch it?
It was, well, first and foremost, it was the grading, obviously, of where it sits on Rotten Tomatoes, because I just think it's
ridiculously low,
exactly. But you know, I have very fond memories of this film. I remember renting it from Blockbuster Video back in the Stone Age, and I just, you know, it was right up my street. You know, it's spoof. I love spoof films. Watched many of them with my dad growing up, and it's horror, you know, and I'm a big fan of Dracula at the time. We were doing Dracula in my English lessons in school, and so it was something I was very familiar with, and I'm a big fan of monster movies, so it's everything I could want, really.
Yeah, it's one of those things where there are certain characters that the minute, you know, the character is brought back to the big screen in whatever kind of format, you kind of get geared up for it. And Dracula's kind of one of them.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's Leslie Nielsen, it's Mel Brooks. It should be a match made in heaven.
Well, we're about to find out. But before we do, before we return to Transylvania to visit Dracula, it is time to take this film and trailerize it.
The mere mention of his name strikes fear into the hearts of millions. Nosferatu. Vlad the Impaler, Count Dracula. And what better actor to bring the menace and presence of the Lord of the Undead than the guy who played Mr. Magoo? Leslie Nielsen dons the cape and bad accent in Dracula, Dead and Loving It. He's looking for a few good necks to suck in this script that sucks even harder. But standing in his way is Van Helsing. No, not the Hugh Jackman version. Not even the Christopher Plummer version. Hell, it isn't even the Wallace Shawn version. No, this Van Helsing is Mel Brooks, and not even the Schwartz can help him now. strap in for a movie that will make you wonder if you can die by simply watching it. Dracula, Dead and Loving It, rated PG-13 for Pantomime Gothic.
Wow, was it PG-13 over there? It was only a PG here.
It's apparently it's PG-13, and it's one of those things where I always find it fascinating as to what a film is rated here versus what it's rated over the pond. So, you know, so for North American audiences, it's PG-13. But let's get into who is in this film. The movie stars Leslie Nielsen, Mel Brooks, Peter McNichol, Steven Weber, Lizette Anthony, Amy Yasbeck, and Harvey Korman. There is also an almost starring for this film. In the role of Dracula, apparently Kelsey Grammer was actually being considered for it. Personally, I would have put, you know, Kelsey Grammer in a different role than Dracula, but I could see him in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, he's got that sort of American poshness, I suppose, that would sort of fit with the rather sort of extravagant English accents that are in this film. He would definitely have been able to pull that off, I think. But, I mean, yeah, I can't see him as Dracula. I don't think the sort of styling of the Dracula character in this film, it wouldn't have suited Kelsey Grammer's style of comedy.
Now, also, according to Steven Weber, Kelsey Grammer was also offered the role of Jonathan Harker. And then I could see a little bit more than playing Dracula in this.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, Steven Weber's Jonathan Harker is a lot more Fraser-esque than any other character in this film. So I could definitely see that. Yeah.
Maybe a little bit more Niles than Fraser, but you know, we'll go with that here. The movie is written by Mel Brooks, Ruby DeLuca, and Steve Haberman. And it is the last ever film that Mel Brooks directed. Mm. The film had a budget of $30 million and grossed only $10.7 million. When it was released on the December 22nd, 1995 weekend, according to thenumbers.com, it debuted at number 10 with only $2.7 million. The highest grossing film that week was the release of Waiting to Exhale with $14 million. Also debuting that weekend, there was a lot of films debuting on this weekend. You had Grumpier Old Men, which debuted at number 4. Sudden Death, which debuted at number 8, and Tom and Huck, which debuted at number 9. Now, it should be noted, before we get to the critic score on this one, that of every single Mel Brooks movie where he was either a writer, producer, or actor, this film has the lowest tomatometer of any of them. Over at Rotten Tomatoes, this film has an audience score of 49% and a tomatometer, and I said it was criminally low, at 11%. Like, yeah. It feels criminal, like literally criminal. Anything with Leslie Nielsen and Mel Brooks involved to rate it that low.
Exactly, and I think you just look at the audience score, you know, nearly 50%. It just speaks volumes, I think, to this film and how sort of lovable it is.
Now, admittedly, if you're going to compare this to a film like Young Frankenstein or To Be or Not to Be or Spaceballs, which, for the record, by the way, Spaceballs also qualifies for this podcast, which I can't even wrap my head around. Because Spaceballs, yeah, I know, right? The audience score, it's off the charts, right? Spaceballs qualifies for this show. I don't get it. But then you have 11%, like, the what?
Yeah, I just, it's criminal. It's really criminal. 11% is just quite unbelievable.
Yeah. To be fair. I mean, I understand that, you know, comedy is subjective, right? And when I say Spaceballs does qualify, it's borderline, I have to admit. It sits at a 57% tomatometer. Mm-hmm. So it's not like it qualifies a lot, but it still qualifies. It's under that 60%. Like, the tomato is green. The movie could be seen. So at some point, Spaceballs will get defended on this show, guaranteed.
Yeah, yeah. Could I possibly pick two Mel Brooks films in a row?
I see no foul there. I see no foul whatsoever. We'll just put that on the cork board. We'll be all good.
Yeah.
But let's figure this out. Let's figure out what the critics did not like about this film and what they got wrong about it. We're going to start with Leslie Nielsen, who, of course, plays Nosferatu himself, Dracula. How was he for this?
Well, I think, it's quite a shame to say that this is certainly not one of Leslie Nielsen's strongest performances in a spoof film. And I think that sort of comes from, because Nielsen really excels when he's playing things absolutely sort of straight, you know, Naked Gun, Airplane. Obviously, there is two sort of most lauded performances, which he doesn't really get to do here. It's obviously a very campy interpretation of Dracula. And, you know, he, in other films of the 90s of this ilk, you know, things like Wrongly Accused, Spy Hard, they're very similar performances from Leslie Nielsen. But, you know, as with anything from Leslie Nielsen, it just gives you this warm feeling. It's like, he's like, just, you know, you're feeling safe with him in this kind of film. And you know that you're going to have fun. And you do have fun. You know, there are moments, you know, there's the sort of visual comedy as well as the, you know, the sort of, I can't get the word out. You know, as well as the comedy in the script, which he does really well. I mean, like I say, I don't think certainly not his best performance in a spoof film, but it fits what you really want and what's quite safe. You know, the pratfalls down the stairs. the one that always gets me is the popping the hair off. It's like, you know, that's obviously embedded in us from Bram Stoker's Dracula, this flamboyant hairdo that Count Dracula has, and just sort of just the way it just casually pops it onto the hat stand is brilliant.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, obviously, there was a lot taken from Bram Stoker's Dracula, which came out before, I think, about 3 years before this or something like that. But the thing is, I think the biggest problem with Leslie Nielsen in this, and it's not Leslie Nielsen, I think you're right, it's the script, in that you mentioned Airplane and the Naked Gun movies, and those are Zucker Abrams Zucker productions, right? And they knew how to write for Leslie Nielsen, and it's almost like, you know, that trio of writers and Leslie Nielsen were all on the same page as far as the delivery and how those lines should play to the camera. Zucker, Abrams Zucker, right for the camera. The thing about Mel Brooks, and if you go back and take a look at some of his earlier films, you realize that it feels more like he's writing a stage play that just happens to be being filmed. There are moments that play out, and I could see someone taking this script and putting it on a Broadway stage, and you know, it felt really, really good. But Nielsen, as good as he is, feels more comfortable in a Zucker Abrams Zucker script as opposed to a Mel Brooks script.
Yeah, I think you're right there. Yeah, and I think it's, you know, a lot of the Dracula character gets a lot of the easy comedy in this film. It doesn't get a lot to sort of, there's not a lot of nuance to the comedy that's coming out of the Dracula character.
Yeah, and the other thing too is, again, maybe it's we're so used to this with the Zucker Abrams Zucker films, is that they're very slapstick, you know, they're very chock-a-block full of little comedic one-liners and pratfalls throughout the entire film. Like, you don't stop laughing during those movies. Like, it's rapid-fire almost. With this one, and I don't know if you felt this at all, but it felt like this one at times felt like it wanted to be almost a more serious Dracula film than it was intended to be.
Yeah, it has to still sort of take time to tell the story rather than just have gag after gag. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like, even, you know, we recently covered Superhero Movie on this, which was another David Zucker production. And that one, again, has the rapid fire comedic beats to it. You know, even the scary movie ones, even the ones that Leslie Nielsen were involved in, right? Yeah. Again, like just chock a block, like keep hitting them with pratfalls and one-liners and whatnot and throwaway lines. This one felt like it took a little bit of time to build the scene, and it wasn't always like, let's just constantly throw things at the audience.
Yeah, for sure.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Steven Weber, who played Jonathan Harker, plays this very straight. Now, there are always actors in the movie where you need them to play it straight, and let the comedy happen around them. Did he work for this? For you?
I think so. Yeah, because I think he gets, you know, although he's not got a great deal to do for the most part in the film, he gets some quite funny moments. You know, the "she's Italian" line was a personal highlight for me, and obviously the stake through the heart, which is just just a fantastic comedy moment. But I will say he's got quite a convincing British accent as well.
I will say, like, kudos to him, because apparently he didn't know he was going to get covered in that much blood.
Yes.
They said, like, you're going to get splashed, you know, not doused, but splashed, right? So apparently when he says the line, "she's dead enough," he was like, no, we're good. I don't need to get hit again with all of this. Kudos to him for kind of holding it together, because, like, if you're not expecting that much blood to hit you in the face... Like, he held it together, like, really, really good. And that's the thing, like, you know, the best parts of some of these comedies are the characters in the story, that this is very serious while everything happens around them. And I think you needed a Steven Weber performance as Jonathan Harker for this to work.
Yes, absolutely. Because there's not a lot of straight characters in this film, certainly not compared to some of the best spoof films. For sure, maybe Amy Asbeck as well. But there's not a lot of straight characters in this film.
Yeah, I mean, you take a look at a movie like Spaceballs, and I would almost equate Weber's performance as Harker to Daphne Zuniga as the damsel in distress, in that she's playing it straight while everyone gets to have, like, the better comedy lines around her, but you need that grounding because that's part of the main story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mel Brooks as Abraham Van Helsing. You can't have a Mel Brooks movie without Mel Brooks in it. Mm. So, without saying, you know, whether this worked for you or not, in the pantheon of Mel Brooks appearances in his own films, how does this one stand up against the rest?
I think it's probably to the lower end, I think. And I think the main problem is there's a bit too much Mel Brooks in this film. You look at Spaceballs, you look at something like Blazing Saddles, there are only sort of bit parts where he sort of plops in here and there, but he's in a good chunk of this film. And I think he maybe struggles to sort of command that much screen time, I think, especially in this.
Yeah. I mean, like, with Spaceballs, it works. Even though he's got the dual roles, both as President Scroob and as Yogurt, which, brilliant, just brilliant. But but it's not the main story. And here, he is a major part of the story. And it's one of those things where it's like, maybe he was too close to the script and too close to the actual production, because there were moments when I'm watching this, and then there's one specifically where, and I think it was Harker and Van Helsing are like walking in the garden, and the shot starts to dissolve to it. They're standing there, and then the dissolve finishes, and then they start walking. It's like, where's the editing in this? Like, take about a second or two off that shot, because we come in and it feels like the director says, okay, and go, right? And they left it in.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it's maybe, the amount of screen time he gets is maybe a budgetary thing, just to sort of keep the cost down a little bit. I don't really know. I mean, this film certainly, it's not a low budget for this film at all, but it certainly doesn't look, you look back to Robin Hood, Men in Tights, and the production value on that film compared to this one, it looks like they weren't giving Mel Brooks as much money as previous.
And that's the thing too, like with $30 million, there's also a lot of set work in this as well. Like, with the ballroom dancing scene and with the castle and the grave, like there's a lot of set work that went into this, and the sets I think work well for the movie that it is. But, it's missing something, and I'm not quite sure exactly what it is.
But then if you look at the sets in Transylvania and even Dracula's castle, they look like knocked up sets, basically.
It almost feels like, I mean, obviously you're going to have sets, with a movie like Spaceballs, because you can't go to outer space. But like even like the fake Tatooine scene and whatnot, that at least, felt and was kind of real, even though when they got to Yogurt's Cave, clearly a set. It's almost like they needed to take a page out of like the Monty Python playbook and actually go somewhere and shoot it, as opposed to try and do it all on a soundstage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it probably would have added that production value that it's sort of sorely missing.
We've talked about her before on the show when we did the episode on Crawl. Lizette Anthony, who plays Lucy in this, how was she for you?
I think she's very suitable for the role. She's obviously a very sort of buxom beauty that sort of fits the Lucy Westerner character. Anybody who's got an ounce of sort of knowledge about Dracula's, the history of Dracula and the character of Lucy, she fits that sort of naivety. She doesn't get a great deal to do in terms of comedy, but it's certainly the right tone for the film. And in every iteration of Dracula, the transformation of Lucy and her coming back from the dead is always a big moment, and it's probably one of the better sort of set pieces of the film, and her sort of coming on to Jonathan Harker and him recoiling because he's British is again a really funny moment, and that's sort of helped by Lizette Anthony's performance.
I never thought I'd say, Kroll clearly prepared someone for something, but it felt like her role in Kroll actually did prepare her for this, because from a looks perspective, she fits that era type of look. And, like she looked like she was having fun with this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, I mean, again, she doesn't get too much to do in the way of comedy, but when it gets to that moment where she can really, really shine and ham it up, she does it brilliantly.
Yeah. To quote her from an interview, and this is also on imdb.com if you're looking for this quote, this is how she talked about her role. Quote, "I was just meant to be there with my tits hanging out looking ridiculously glamorous, and no, I didn't find it offensive being that sort of sexy foil." Like, yes, obviously it's a Mel Brooks film. Mm-hmm. So, say what you will about the comedy, whether it works for you or not, but Mel Brooks's films, while some of them may not have aged well, they were never, for lack of a better term, exploitative of someone's looks. Like, clearly she was picked for the look because it's a Dracula film and she has that very Victorian style beauty to her, you know, and like, she fit the role perfectly.
Yeah, well, you know, it's Dracula. So you got, you know, if you're going to parody different iterations of Dracula, then this, you know, that, that sort of her role and her look is very much about the Hammer Dracula films. And, and you know, that's actresses like that were ten a penny in the Hammer Dracula films. So, you know, it's it fits, you know, the parody and the spoofing of the history of Dracula in cinema.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, moving on to the other main female actress in this, Amy Yazbek, who played Mina Harker. Again, another one whose look perfectly fits the era that they're aiming for this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, another decent British accent. I think, you know, obviously she'd hone that on Men in Tights as well. But, you know, she doesn't get a great deal to do in this film. Really, you know, there's a few sort of physical gags with the stand, new stand up, new sit down, and getting that right, which obviously works really well and is really funny. But she, you know, she doesn't get a whole heap to do, and is a little bit forgettable, I think, in this role.
I mean, yes, she's given more to work with, you know, than Lizette Anthony, because, well, Lizette Anthony doesn't make it to the end of the film. By the way, spoilers, but, you know, I hate to say it, this film is, you know, a year shy of 30 years old. So, yeah, you know, not to make you all, you know, feel old, but I'm going to make you all feel old here. I thought she was great in Men in Tights. I absolutely loved her in Men in Tights. And of course, she was also in The Mask as well. You know, like a really good comedic actress. So obviously Mel Brooks, who has worked with her before, you know, go work with your friends, right? It's always a good practice to get around that. Given the amount that Mina had in this movie and given the amount that Lucy had, would you swap the actresses and put Lizette Anthony in the Mina Harker role and Amy Yazbek in the Lucy role, or would you have kept it that way?
No, I'd definitely have kept it that way. I think I can't see... I can't see Amy Yazbek doing the... doing that whole scene with Lucy coming back from the dead. I just can't picture it. I think Lizette Anthony's got much more of that look, that, you know, like I say, that Hammer look, that really suits that role. And I don't think Amy Yazbek could have pulled that off.
I will say too that, you know, Amy Yazbek in the dance scene, it worked so well, and she's a very good physical comedian as well. And yes, I recognize that, you know, there's stunt doubles and whatnot and dance doubles, I get it. But for the scenes where you can clearly tell that it's Amy Yazbek, she does that very, very well. Yeah, I think you're right. I think, like, they had the actresses perfect for the roles they were in, and both work well in this.
But why are you mentioning that dancing? Don't you think that it's funnier the fact that you can actually see that the stunt doubles, dance doubles?
Oh, absolutely.
It makes it funnier.
Like, and it's not like, you know, we didn't have a dance double for Leslie Nielsen before in one of the Naked Gun films. Like, it's perfect in its comedy as well. You know, like it's funnier that you know that they're just professional dancers with, like, a wig or whatnot. I mean, hell, they even made fun of the idea of the stunt double in Spaceballs. Of course, when they dive through the door and all that, and they get up, it's like, that's their stunt doubles, you know? And you got, like, some guy with a beard with the long Daphne Zuniga wig. And, like, it's funny. Like, we get it. We completely understand, you know, it's a tip of the hat to the audience. Like, we're not trying to pull one over on you. We're going to make it a bit as obvious as possible, but here we are.
Yeah.
Harvey Korman as Dr. Seward. I mentioned earlier that I could easily see Kelsey Grammer in this movie, but maybe not in the roles that he was, you know, thought of. I could have seen Kelsey Grammer in the Dr. Seward role, no problem whatsoever.
Yeah, I could see that now that you say it. Yeah. It's definitely got that, I can see it.
But that being said, you know, it would also be maybe a little bit too typecast, because, you know, Dr. Fraser Crane, Dr. Seward, like, might have been too obvious, and maybe Kelsey Grammer didn't want to go down that road. But getting to Harvey Korman's performance in this, again, went the Steven Weber route and played it straight while the crazy happened around them between Leslie Nielsen and Mel Brooks.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Harvey Korman, I mean, it took me ages to figure out that this was Hedley Lamarr from Blazing Saddles. It just did not click with me until I researched this episode, actually. But yeah, he's, you know, it's a very silly performance. I think it's quite one note, really. He doesn't have a great deal of gags other than a very funny one about giving people an enema to all the people in his asylum. His method of trying to cure them is to keep giving them enemas because it will, and I quote, give them an enormous sense of achievement.
Yeah, I remember like the third time he mentioned it, it's like he's into enemas like Dr. Phil is into spanking. Like there's something wrong with this character here, but it is, you know, I get it. You want to have kind of those running gags as well. And I think that one worked well for him.
Yeah, but I think it's just that little bit too over the top, I think, his performance, his voice, you know, is maybe that's to hide whether or not, you know, he could do a British accent. I don't know, but it's just that little bit too over the top for me.
I'm really glad you said over the top and not because I want to watch a Stallone film, but bear with me here. Peter McNichol. Ooh, I got thoughts on Peter McNichol, but I'm gonna let you have first crack at him for this one.
Well, I might shock you actually here because I love Peter McNichol. I absolutely love him, and I love him in this film. Yes, it's over the top, but I think Peter McNichol is somebody who can pull it off. He's just fantastically maniacal. You know, it just excels in these kind of roles where he's just utterly mental, basically. He's got quite a convincing British accent. I'm going to keep mentioning accents. I think he just gets a lot of really funny moments. And he's just this switch between this sort of, you know, stifled upper class English gentleman and this demented fool. It's just a sight to behold. And I absolutely love it. This, you know, the scene where he gets accosted by the Brides of Dracula in bed, it just always makes me laugh. The line, "My God, what are you doing to the furniture?" will always tickle me. And yeah, I love Peter McNichol's performance in this film.
See. We're gonna differ on this one here. Okay. Just let me get this out here. You mentioned Airplane earlier in the episode, and freaking love Airplane. It's a great film. No one will ever deny Airplane is a great film and a comedy masterpiece. However, if I had to remove one person out of Airplane, it would be Steven Stucker, because his performance in that felt so tonally different and out of character, or at least out of situation with everything else that was going around. Like, everyone was playing the comedy straight, but the lines were so good. Steven Stucker is sitting there, like, maniacal in the air traffic control tower, you know, like, shaking people and unplugging things. And going, it's like, oh, my God, leave. Just leave, you know. I get it, but I don't get it. And that's the one part of Airplane that I didn't like. Here, you know, with his Renfield performance, Peter McNichol kind of reminds me of that Steven Stucker too crazy for the moment thing. And I think there's the thing, you know, in a movie like The Naked Gun, right, everything is chock-a-block crazy fun. Mm-hmm. And I think a performance like Peter McNichol's in this would have worked in something like that. But because the scenes and the moments are given the time to breathe, to build up for the gag, it's almost like Renfield is trying too hard. Right. And I get that that's how he's directed to do it. You know, and it's not like we haven't talked about Peter McNichol on this show before, because, of course, he was in Baby Geniuses and, you know, he was actually really good in that piece of crap film. But, you know, here he's just turned to 11 And that's one more than 10. And this film is sitting at about a, you know, an 8 or 9 volume, and he's turned up way louder than everybody else in this.
I just think, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I just think it's great. I love his performance in this film. I think he does sort of maniacal really well. I think it just, yeah. And I think obviously the character of Renfield, you know, historically is supposed to be that this demented, and he's supposed to be that sort of over the top when, you know, he's serving his master. And I think it's, you know, it's again, it's a bit of a homage to the portrayal in the 31 Dracula. But it's certainly dialed up to 11, but I didn't mind it maybe as much as you did.
Maybe that's the thing too. And you said how it's very reminiscent of the 1931 Dracula. Is this movie almost too reverential to the source material of the various versions of Dracula rather than just focusing on the comedy in the moment?
Yes, I think that probably is its biggest failing. Yeah. Yeah. It's trying to keep to one particular style of Dracula rather than, you know, parried in, you even look at a film like Spaceballs or even Blazing Saddles, you know, Westerns and science fiction, you know, the Spaceballs doesn't just parody Star Wars. Blazing Saddles just doesn't just parody a single Western film, but it's almost like this film is just parodying a particular Dracula.
And there's the thing too, right? Like, it's almost more homage than it is parody. You know, at least, you know, with the scary movie films, and yes, I'm getting back to like the Zucker Abrams Zucker kind of productions, mm-hmm. you know, it's the genre that they're parodying, yeah. right? Spaceballs, they're parodying the genre. They're just using Star Wars as the vehicle for it, you know. But mm-hmm. the fact that they even got to get a jab in at Transformers with Mega Maid and whatnot, like mm-hmm. there's a lot that you can work with. With Blazing Saddles, you have the entirety of Western films and that entire genre to pull from, even if you're going to lean on to one thing. Again, something as, you know, qualifying for this podcast as superhero movie, yes, it used the Spider-Man films, as at least the Tobey Maguire ones, mm-hmm. as its launch point for the story, but it parodied a lot of different superhero movies, and I get that. Mm-hmm. You know, there is a lot you can do by parodying the Dracula, you know, mystique and the story and the various versions. But this felt more like it was paying homage to it, and just the little things. Like, even when Leslie Nielsen goes in to bite Lucy, the fact that he covers their heads with the cape, that's specifically taken straight from, and I can't remember which version of Dracula it was, but he did that to pay homage to that version. It's almost like mm-hmm. they were trying to make fun of Dracula, but at the same time trying to be very respectful of Dracula. And I don't think in a movie like this you can really kind of jump that line.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we've got the most, up until that point, the most modern version of Dracula was Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula, of which there are a couple of beats to that. Obviously, the hair that I mentioned earlier, the shadow, which is, again, is a very funny moment, falling down the stairs and he gets up and the shadows hurt his back. Other than that, you know, that's the most sort of, you know, the most sort of modern interpretation that would have maybe made more sense to more people in 1995 than perhaps, you know, 1931 Dracula. So I think if they'd have pushed that a little bit more as well, because there is a lot, you know, there's a lot that you could have, you know, parodied from that Francis Ford Coppola Dracula that would probably have worked.
And I think there's the other thing, too, is like this film came out in 1995. So the Francis Ford Coppola version of Dracula is complete and utter fair game. And it's still fresh in the mind of people who mm-hmm. have recently watched it. But if they're making reference and homage notes to like a version from 1931, the movie going audience that's going to pay to see this aren't necessarily the ones that are going back and watching the 1931 Dracula before, to prep for the, going to see a Mel Brooks and Leslie Nielsen film. It's probably not going to happen. I think maybe more so if rather than focus on Dracula per se, but focus more on the genre of the monster movie and kind of use some of those, universal monsters as the, again, very similar to Monster Squad in that how it played upon, not just Dracula, but all the other monsters from that monster movie era and, pulled them into the story. Here, it almost needed more of that gothic kind of like covering all bases rather than just we're doing a Dracula story and that's it.
Yeah. Because then the base in the comedy around specific set piece is not anything wider than that. Yeah. So you're only sort of you're confined to that story and nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, if they had come out and done, for lack of a better term, vampire movie, then you could play on, the various different tropes. You could play on the Lost Boys. You could play on Dracula. You can play on, Once Bitten. You could play on anything that's got a freaking vampire in it. And if you were to make that movie today, you could, spoof things like The Vampire Diaries and True Blood, lots of different vampire genre based films, but you really kind of, handcuff yourself if you're just going to stick with the Dracula storyline. I think that may be where it shoehorned itself into painted itself into a corner, right? Mm-hmm. By not tackling more of the genre, by staying into one little corner of it, you limit the amount of gags that you could have with it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, some of the funny, one that I've got to mention because it always tickles me every time I watch this. And it's, and it's not just a parody of something that happens in a Dracula film. It's something that happens in vampire films. It's reasonably specific as opposed to the Dracula stories. But the brides, when they come into the bedroom, into Renfield, and they're floating in, and then he scolds them for trying to drink the blood of Renfield, and they start to float away, and he's like, stop floating, and they just start to stomp out of the room in a mood, and that's just great. That's just proper comedy to me. But that's parodying something that's outside of specifically of the Dracula story, and I think if it had a little bit more of that, then
yeah, I think there are some great beats in this. There are some great comedic moments in this. It's almost like there needed to be more of them and more frequent rather than, use a scene for one gag. Like you almost want to toss more one-liners and off-the-cuff kind of comments and just cram more into it. And that's the thing, right? Like it's still a funny film and it's way better than 11%. Like,
absolutely.
I get if you are comparing this to Mel Brooks's biggest works, then this is going to fall behind a little bit. And I get, this is not as good as Spaceballs. This is not as good as, say, History of the World Part 1, right? But it's not 11%.
No, not at all. Not at all. And, it's almost, I would say it's almost like a nice little family comedy as well. I think it's something you could sit and watch with your kids. It's very simple. It's not too, it's not too violent. It's not too, sexual or anything like that. There's one or two bits maybe, but nothing that we've not seen in film, comedy films of the 80s that are considered family films and stuff. But I think it's just a nice, simple comedy that will still make you smile. It might not make your belly laugh, but it'll make you smile.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if my kids watch this film, I'm not going to be concerned at all. It is completely and utterly, it's harmless fun. It is harmless fun. If you want some simple laughs, when the kids are sitting there going, oh, okay, can we change the channel? I mean, but maybe not your kids. My kids would definitely not want to watch this at all because it doesn't have lots of explosions. My kids like that. But regardless of, it's still, you know, if your kids want a decent laugh, this film is not going to traumatize them by any stretch of the imagination. No. You know, it is family friendly.
It'd be more traumatizing when you have to explain what an enema is.
Yep. Just tell them, like, kids, remember that time we all went to Taco Bell and you guys ate too much and, you know, the next day was not fun? Picture that through a hose. All right. Pete, it's come time. So let us figure this one out. First, 11% is the critic score. If you're rating this out of 100, where are you actually putting it?
Being very realistic about this, I would say I would go along with the audience score from Rotten Tomatoes, which is, what, 48?
It was about that, yeah.
Yeah, I think around the 50, the 50 mark, I think is fair for this film.
Yeah, a 49% audience score. And yeah, I think that's kind of where this sits. Like, it's not Mel Brooks' best,
no,
but it's not bad. You know, and, you know, maybe it pales in comparison and that's what the critics are comparing it to. I understand that part, but it's definitely not an 11%. I think you're right. I think it sits about that 45 to 50%. More if you get rid of Peter McNichol.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one. But I mean, you know, maybe this came a little very too quickly after Men in Tights, because it was only 2 years after that. So I think, you know, that maybe didn't help it either. But
I mean, and especially too, because Men in Tights was so good. But there's the other thing too, is that Robin Hood Men in Tights sticks to the Robin Hood story, but I think it does that better than this does the Dracula story.
Yeah, but I think it's like we discussed the thing that sort of parodied for the most part Prince of Thieves, which had come very close, you know, a couple of years before it, and it still had some other parts that were, you know, from the sort of expanded lore and other different films from that sort of genre as well. So I think that's, again, you know, maybe why it wasn't jumped on as much from the audiences at the time than it was.
It's interesting too, and I remember reading this article a while back, so don't know if the numbers are still the same, but I'm pretty sure that they're still up there, is that when you take a look at stories that have been adapted to different properties, the story of Robin Hood, I think, is the most translated piece of literature to TV and film. Like, there are more Robin Hood TV shows, or at least TV theme shows or movies out there, than any other IP in existence.
Really?
I mean, you have years where there are multiple Robin Hood properties that have come out. Like, trust me when I say, take a look at the list of films and TV shows that are based on the story of Robin Hood. It will blow your mind how many times that story is told and retold.
Wow, okay.
So, check that out. So at least with Robin Hood Men in Tights, you had different way too more iterations to poke fun of and play homage, or at least pull your comedy from. But they didn't do Rocket Robin Hood. No Rocket Robin Hood. My inner child cries because there was no rockets at all in Men in Tights. But Pete, it's come time for the big one here. Who is your MVP of Dracula Dead and Loving It?
I'm going to get my revenge on the Grading on a Curve episode. And my MVP for this episode is Mr. Peter McNichol.
I knew you were going to say that.
I feel no shame. I can't get enough of him in this film.
See, I'm going to go the other way, and my MVP is Steven Weber. Like, I love what he did with Jonathan Harker, and I think he anchored the movie enough that the comedy could work around him very, very well. And his ability to keep it, you know, in line almost allowed everyone else the space to have that comedy, and that worked out well. Yeah. Even Peter McNichol. even Peter McNichol. Peter, thanks you so much for coming on and talking about this film. Before we go, please remind our viewers where they can find the Movie Duel podcast out there on the interwebs.
Okay, so you can find us on all good podcast apps, channels, wherever you find your podcasts. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, on X and Threads at Movie Duel Pod, and you can now find us on Patreon as well, which we have for a small fee. You can get some bonus content from us as well, which has been launched this week.
Trust me when I say, listen to the Movie Duel podcast. You will love the show, and then go support them. Give them that 5-star rating wherever you get your podcasts. Phenomenal show. Phenomenal team. Peter, thank you so much. Remember, you're always welcome here anytime whatsoever. And to you, our listeners, you guys know the drill. If there is a movie out there that you think is unfairly maligned or is just so bad that there is no way in Transylvania that we can find anything good to say about it, hit us up on social media at NotThatBadCast or go to our website at NotThatBadCast.com. And while you're there, check out our new Coming Soon page where you can see all the movies that we are preparing to talk about. We want to hear your thoughts on those movies and all the other shows. Like, there's tons of places for you to put your comments in. We want to shout you out in the shows, so drop us a line. Until next time, he's Peter, I'm Jay. You guys are awesome. This is It's Not That Bad, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Take care.